This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Sea turtle nesting season is underway along the North Carolina coast. Coming up in 10 minutes, we hear how volunteers with the North Carolina Aquarium help rescue, rehabilitate, and release injured or weak sea turtle hatchlings. But first, North Carolina may soon experience an influx of military equipment as leaders in the defense industry determine where to funnel supplies returning from overseas. This retrograde, or the movement and redistribution of equipment, is the largest in recorded history, and it may impact the local economy. Lee Jenkins has more.
As the war in Afghanistan winds down, already overloaded military depots across the nation will experience a huge surge in returning equipment, with $16 billion of the $28 billion of equipment currently overseas coming home later this year. According to the Vice President of North Carolina's Eastern Region Economic Development Council, Mark Sutherland, this is good news for Eastern North Carolina's economy, both in the short term and the long term.
We built a fairly compelling business case to share with the defense logistics world to bring a lot of that supply chain activity to North Carolina. The retrograde is going to be a big stimulus. It's going to start happening this fall. It's going to last for 2 or 3 years. And in those 2 or 3 points, our state has an opportunity to catch a wave, to actually demonstrate what we have put on paper for the last 2 years, that doing defense supply chain business in eastern North Carolina is the best deal for the federal government.
What exactly makes the supply chain business look so favorable in North Carolina? For starters, the high density of military bases and personnel, coupled with the supply of skilled and trained labor in the form of ex-military workers, provides direct contact with the customer and a reliable workforce. On top of that, North Carolina already has the logistical capacity needed to handle supply chain activities.
We have, in the North Carolina's military region, 2 maritime ports, 4 military-certified aerial ports. We have a very robust east-west, north-south road and rail network, and all of that is operating at about 30% of its design capacity. So not only do we have a density of the end users here, we have this massive amount of logistics infrastructure that you don't have to spend any money to develop or to build it.
Due to the lack of a concrete plan for returning equipment, the exact or even approximate effect of the retrograde on the region is impossible to determine at this time. According to Sutherland, however, recent trends in the defense industry indicate what types of jobs may be generated and where they may be generated.
Defense industry is doing depot work now in locations of their choosing, and industry is deciding to do that close to the end user for all the right reasons, not just to save transportation costs, but more importantly, to decrease turnaround time and in such a way that the readiness of their customer, their military end user, is enhanced.
Examples of those trends can already be seen in some businesses in eastern North Carolina.
Oshkosh in Jacksonville is an excellent example. Doing work that traditionally has been done at a military depot now is being done by private industry out in town, and work not just on Marine Corps vehicles, but Army and Navy vehicles and National Guard as well. Lockheed Martin's doing similar activity in Fayetteville, General Dynamics in New Bern, Havelock.
Returning equipment is already generating jobs in the region. And these jobs aren't limited to vehicular repair either. They cover all aspects of logistics functions, such as food and fuel activity, maintenance, supply, transportation, and healthcare. All of the jobs generated will be private sector, though, or at least off of the state's military bases.
The workload won't fall in on our existing military workforce, either active duty military or civilian military workforce. They're all gainfully employed and, I might add, being drawn down.
Still, it's hard to say where exactly these jobs will go.
There's defense contracting going on in 87 of North Carolina's 100 counties. There's more defense contracting going on in Charlotte-Mecklenburg area than around Camp Lejeune and in Onslow County. Same with Wake County, more than Fayetteville or Cumberland County.
According to Sutherland, it will be more of the same.
It's probably just going to add on more of what we've seen in the past, and that is, you know, anybody that wants a piece of that DOD contracting business merely has to roll up their sleeves and get into it.
How much equipment North Carolina will receive and how many jobs the returning equipment will generate will be determined in the next 2 to 3 months. I'm Lee Jenkins.
For more than a decade, North Carolina's Eastern Region Development Commission has provided economic development for a 13-county region in eastern North Carolina by working with companies that want to locate their business here. But as state funding for the program dries up, the organization is seeking nonprofit status to continue operating. L.C. Morris tells us how North Carolina's Eastern Region has been involved with helping businesses thrive in eastern North Carolina.
When it comes to economic development, state taxpayers from 1993 to 1999 funded and founded a regional municipality with the addition of a $5 license tag fee. Created by the North Carolina Legislature, the North Carolina's Eastern Region Development Commission is the economic development agency for a 13-county region, which includes Carteret, Craven, Duplin, Edgecombe, Greene, Jones, Lenoir, Nash, Onslow, Pamlico, Pitt, Wayne, and Wilson counties. John Chafee is the president and CEO of North Carolina's Eastern Region.
The $5 license tag fee was every time someone went to renew their license plate for a five-year period back in the mid-90s, from, I guess it was 1994 to 1999, they paid an extra $5 charged by the state to essentially create our organization. 85% of that money was put into a trust fund for each county, and 15% of the money revenue generated by that license tag fee was put into a general fund, if you will, to pay for operational expenses of our agency.
The commission offers confidential site location assistance and information to companies considering locating their business or expansion in eastern North Carolina. Over the past years, North Carolina's Eastern Region Development Commission, or NCER, has assisted in the joint venture of Bosch and Siemens Home Appliances Group to move stateside and take over the vacated Bosch facility in New Bern for manufacturing. They also helped Sanderson Farms with an expansion site in Kinston and the relocation of Frank Door Company to Newport.
We serve those counties by assisting them with what we call capacity building. Initially, that was in providing funding to them to develop industrial sites or industrial parks, build shell buildings, basically to position those counties for new and expanding industry growth. We've transitioned in terms of that capacity building that we now get engaged in workforce development items.
NCER also participates in specific projects, marketing programs, and efforts to help economic professionals in the region access the best in technology and educational opportunities, continues Chafee.
What our companies like about that is exposing kids at an earlier age to the relevancy of their science, math, technology education with career opportunities that exist in eastern North Carolina, getting our private sector companies involved and engaged and being supportive of teachers that are in the middle schools. We think that'll have long-term benefits to key employers throughout eastern North Carolina.
By 2016, STEM East Centers will be present in at least 31 middle schools in North Carolina's eastern region. But for now,
Wayne, Lenoir, Jones, Craven, and now Duplin have benefited from STEM East. We've gone out and secured grants to be able to start with at least one or two STEM centers in each one of those counties. And they took our original grant funding that we received. In some cases, they've turned that around and leveraged those funds and the results from those projects to be able to secure support from private foundations or the federal government.
North Carolina's Eastern Region has not always gone by that name. It was originally created as the Global Transpark Development Commission and the Global Transpark Development Zone. The name change was due to the continuing confusion with the Global Transpark Authority, a state entity also known as the GTP, based in Kinston. Chafee says throughout their 19-year existence, they have provided over $6.7 million in grants to the 13 counties to improve their competitive position and aid them in securing 13,600 new jobs.
Are you interested in expanding? Would you consider the Southeast, and particularly North Carolina? If so, would you be interested in locating in eastern North Carolina? And if they say yes, then we start working on that company and determining what are their needs. About 85% of all clients look for an existing building. right out of the gate, if you don't have an available building, the odds are you're not going to be able to meet the needs of a particular client. We work with that client. We develop that relationship. We determine that they really do have a viable project. They're capable of executing. We'll connect with our local economic developers to say, can you meet these criteria established by this company for their new expansion location?
Counties that borrow against their individual trust funds have particularly low interest rates.
The highest rate of interest we currently charge is something like 4.4% or 4.475%. And right now, the interest on those funds, if a county wanted to borrow against that, would be 2%.
As far as a turnaround on the investment, some counties are holding their own.
Jacksonville, Onslow County, actually came and borrowed money from us, as well as others, to be able to build a shell building. Other counties have done that in the past, too, or they've borrowed money to be able to acquire a property and develop that as an industrial park. It puts them in a position to be able to develop the park, finance it over a period of years, say 10 or 15 years, and as they sell property, they can actually recoup their funds to be able to pay off that loan.
North Carolina's Eastern Region provides direct financial assistance to the counties. I'm L.C. Morris.
This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. We turn now from the economy to talk about energy. The Senate has passed requirements for what gas companies must reveal when they're pumping chemicals into the ground during fracking. WFAE's Ben Bradford reports the Senate overrode another government group's more stringent rule.
Hydraulic fracturing releases natural gas or oil from shale rocks by pumping a mix of water and chemicals into them until they crack. It's currently not allowed in the state, but permitting is set to begin in 2015. The question about what companies must disclose about the mix of chemicals has been one of the most contentious for states opening up to fracking. Joe Rasabi, a vice president at the soil and groundwater cleanup company RedoxTech, says that rule matters if there's a spill.
If you're looking at a potential contamination situation, which you hope won't happen, you definitely need to understand what the original chemicals were.
The Senate bill says that companies don't have to disclose chemicals that are confidential or a trade secret. And it comes while the state's Energy and Mining Commission has been on the verge of publishing its own, more stringent rule. It would require companies to disclose all chemicals, but not the measurements of the mix, kind of like ingredients on the back of a can of Coke. Commissioners were critical of what they saw as the Senate's usurping their authority. The commission's Republican-appointed head, Jim Womack, wrote to lawmakers, "This one simple change has reinvigorated anti-drilling fervor across the state, an outcome the commission has worked tirelessly to avoid." For WFAE News, I'm Ben Bradford in Charlotte.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Tryon Palace, announcing Second Saturdays, Fresh from the Past, Food and Culture in Eastern North Carolina, with historic cooking demonstrations, tastings, including chocolate and ice cream, plus tours and activities. Saturday, July 13th from 9 to 5, online at tryonpalace.org.
Hi, I'm Paula Poundstone, and I'm here to ask for your car. No, huh? Funny, that's what most people say. Until I tell them that it's for their favorite programs and that we can turn your old car into Morning Edition and wait, don't tell me. Ever see a used Ford Escort morph into Carl Castle? Pretty neat trick. Turn your car into the programs you love.
For more information on the vehicle donation program, visit publicradioeast.org.
It's sea turtle nesting season along the Carolina coast. Each summer, female sea turtles come ashore, lay their eggs under the sand, and then return into the deep blue ocean. An average of 775 nests are laid each nesting season in North Carolina, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Of the seven sea turtle species in the world, two are commonly found off the North Carolina coast, loggerhead and green sea turtles. With the nesting season upon us, North Carolina aquarium staff are making room to take in injured and weak hatchlings. Director of the aquarium at Pine Knoll Shores, Alan Monroe, says volunteer groups will start patrolling the shoreline soon.
And they will walk those each morning and look for those tracks that the female left as she came up onto shore. They'll then, you know, put in a barrier around the nest when it's found to help protect it from being, you know, driven over by a vehicle or unintentionally dug up by a small child or whatever trying to dig his way to China. And they'll put tags on the nest to help educate the visitors to the beach about what's going on there.
50 to 60 days later, the volunteers return to the same site at night in hopes of seeing the half-dollar coin-sized turtles emerge from the sand and follow the moon's light toward the water.
And the volunteers will sit there and wait patiently for that magical moment. They're typically, you know, buried about 18 inches or so deep. And then in an all-at-once kind of coordinated effort, they will start scrambling up towards the surface, and they literally erupt in a boil of sea turtle legs flapping back and forth and sand going everywhere. And they make that mad dash towards the ocean.
When sea turtles first hatch, their bodies are soft and flexible, an easy meal for raccoons, seagulls, and ghost crabs.
And so in that mad dash to the beach, the ghost crabs are sitting there waiting, and they see them. And sometimes we'll have a turtle brought to us that has an unfortunate encounter with a ghost crab, you know, a flipper that's been cut or torn, and they'll bring those animals here, and we'll be able to nurse them back to health.
After all the sea turtles have hatched naturally, the volunteer excavates the nest and counts the number of eggs. Usually, they find small, weak hatchlings at the bottom of the nest.
And these are animals that, under normal conditions, they would just basically pass away. They are too weak to climb up through the sand by themselves. For whatever reason, they didn't get the signal when everyone else left as a group effort that that was the time to go.
Monroe says they receive dozens of injured or weak sea turtles each nesting season. At the aquarium, they're housed in modified glass aquariums until they're ready to be released.
Sea turtles are not the nicest of animals. They cannot generally be put together because they'll chew on each other. So they're given their little, it might be 6 inches by 10-inch space until they get larger, and then we'll start removing some of the dividers and farm the animals out.
Once the hatchlings are healthy, they are released. Just last week, the North Carolina Aquarium returned 3 juvenile sea turtles to the ocean. One came to the aquarium in August 2011 from an excavated nest. The other 2 were rescued off Cape Lookout in April, a result of cold stunning, a condition much like hypothermia for humans.
Those turtles that have not gotten the cue to the season that they're supposed to have migrated either offshore to the Gulf Stream or further south to more warmer waters, they become trapped here in the nearshore waters and become cold stunned. As a cold-blooded reptile, the sea turtles can't generate their own body temperature. The temperature drops down into the 50s, and the turtles' metabolism starts slowing way down, and pretty soon they can't swim, they can't function anymore, and they just sort of wash up on beaches.
The aquarium and the Wildlife Resources Commission work together to provide care for cold-stunned turtles each year. Monroe says it's not unusual to see upwards of 30 sea turtles at one time.
We have a whole variety of flexible spaces that we can pull out and connect water to and drains. And there's hoses and water running everywhere as we try and make sure the animals get the best possible care they can.
When a cold-stunned turtle arrives at the North Carolina Aquarium, it's weighed, given a number, and gradually warmed up in an isolated tank.
You don't just throw a heat blanket on them or dunk them in warm water. It's a process of slowly and very cautiously raising their body temperature. And then we also have to then make sure that they can swim properly. And so they may be just given a few inches of water to start with, just so they maintain their skin hydration and have something to drink. And as they get stronger, then we'll start giving them greater depths of water until finally they're thrashing about and splashing and swimming. And then we know that's a good sign that they're in good health.
Monroe says cold-stunned turtles are released as soon as they recover, usually in 1 to 2 months. During the cold winter and spring months, this requires boat transportation to the Gulf Stream, where the water temperatures are in the 70s and 80s.
Sometimes we get animals that are in need of more serious long-term care. They may have had injuries when they were being, pounded against the shore because they couldn't swim anymore, or damage from, a seagull or a raccoon that took a bite out of them. And it could take, 4 to 6 months in some cases to make sure those animals are healthy before we send them back out.
Monroe says it's their goal to return the sea turtles to the ocean as soon as possible. However, a small handful of turtles stay at the aquarium for as many as 2 years, serving as ambassadors for their species.
And those animals are given a head start. They're, growing up to a larger size where they have a better chance of surviving in the wild. But while they're here at the aquarium, they can be part of our educational programs. And so we put them in our Sea Turtle Odyssey display where visitors can learn more about the plight of sea turtles in the wild. And so they're standing in to help remind visitors here to the Crystal Coast that, there are other animals besides us out there that need to be given their space and their proper habitat.
The loggerhead and green sea turtles common along our coast are protected under the Endangered Species Act. There are things you can do to minimize your impact on this threatened reptile, such as throwing away plastic bags and other trash that can be easily mistaken by sea turtles as food. Also, filling in holes dug in the sand that baby sea turtles could get trapped in. Residents in oceanfront beach homes should also try to minimize light pollution at night during the summer.
You know, when the sea turtles typically hatch and leave the nest at night, they look for that silvery reflection of the moon and stars off the breaking waves as their cue as to which way to go and head towards the ocean. And unfortunately, lights in parking lots and in condominiums and such that we use can detract the turtles and have them go the wrong way.
If you come across a stranded sea turtle or uncover a nest while you're at the beach this summer, Monroe suggests contacting the Wildlife Resources Commission or the North Carolina Aquarium. You can see pictures of the sea turtles housed at the aquarium, as well as photos of the recovered sea turtles being released last week at Fort Macon. Just visit publicradioeast.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. Well, it's 4th of July weekend, and we know what that's all about. Being with family or large groups of friends, cookouts, picnics, people and food. And of course, that's what agriculture's all about here in eastern North Carolina, people and food. We have farm families growing food for your family. And we're pretty lucky to have them here. In eastern North Carolina, we can find any number of farm stands where vegetables are grown right there within steps of the stand where they're sold, and farmers markets where vegetables grown locally throughout North Carolina can be found. This is a great weekend to go out and find some of those vegetables. Think about red tomatoes, white sweet corn, and blueberries over 4th of July. There's a couple things to keep in mind when you're buying and preparing fresh vegetables. First of all, don't just go to the stand and buy one thing. There's usually going to be 5, 10, 15 different vegetables that are fresh and ready at any one given time. Try something you don't usually try. It's amazing how many fast, simple recipes are available now for almost any vegetable. The most important thing, however, is knowing how to take care of the vegetables when you get them home so that when you do eat them, they are just perfect. A couple simple things. First, don't put tomatoes in the refrigerator. That's right, tomatoes don't belong in the refrigerator. They'll lose their taste and texture. Just let them sit on the counter until it's time to eat them. With almost every other vegetable, if you're not going to eat it the day you get it home, do consider cleaning, preparing, and at least partially cooking, blanching the vegetables before you store them. This serves a couple of purposes. First of all, the worst thing is to spend money on vegetables only to get to them later on and find that you've waited too long and they've gone bad in the refrigerator. If you cook them quickly when you get them home, not overcook them, just a light cooking, it will keep them from going bad, and they'll be ready for you to finish cooking or reheat when it's time to eat them. Even more importantly is knowing that for many vegetables, most of them actually, although some more quickly than others, the sugars in the vegetables turn to starches over time after they've been picked. This is due to enzymes that are in the vegetables that break down the sugars. But you can denature those enzymes, stop them from breaking down the sugars, so that vegetables continue to taste fresh. And you do that with heat. So let's talk about, say, green beans as an example. Bring the green beans home, rinse them, snap the ends off, break them into whatever size you want, and bring a pan of water to a boil. Throw the green beans in and let it come back to a boil, just for a very short time. That's blanching the beans. You can do the same thing with corn or with almost any vegetable. By blanching them, you've denatured those enzymes, And now, when you go back into the fridge to finish cooking or using the vegetable in a recipe, it tastes exactly the same as it would have if you'd eaten it the day it was picked and purchased. It's really simple, and it makes a huge difference. I always do this, with beans and corn especially. As soon as I get them home, I cook them, then stick them in a plastic bag, and when I'm ready to use them, it's just like I walked out in the field and picked them that day. So I hope you can use that little hint. Buy a wide range of vegetables, take them home, and go ahead and process them quickly. They'll be ready for you to throw into your recipes later in the week, and they'll always taste fresh. Keep those tomatoes out of the refrigerator, and be sure to have at least one sandwich with big fat tomato slices, fresh basil, and if you're one of the people like me who like nothing better, throw on a slice of bacon. Have a happy 4th of July weekend, and I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.